Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood, and Chloe Archard. Hi, Chloe.
Hi.
Hi. So we've got another guest this time. I think this is going to be a really, really interesting conversation. We have Carl Seddon, who is the inventor and director of Elixir Probiotics. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So this is actually Carl's first podcast, so we promise to be nice. which we always are, obviously. But Carl, why don't you just get started by telling us about your story, how you got into probiotics, you know, how you developed your product, and you know, why you think it's sort of different or important in that kind of field, because probiotics are obviously really big at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So my interest in this field started from a young age, and I didn't quite know what this field would eventually be. But from a very young age, I noticed a lot of health problems that were very common in society seemed to be at a much higher prevalence than you would expect from an organism such as humans, who have evolved for millions of years. You know, simple examples of this is short-sightedness, teenage acne, all these problems which were so high in prevalence that they really couldn't be attributed to those one-off, like one in a million genetic defects, you know, like being born with six, you know, like five fingers and a thumb. I looked around. I was pretty young at this time, probably early teens, and the usual explanations weren't satisfactory. So things like, oh, teenage people get bad skin because they're teenagers and their hormones. It didn't make any sense to me. I thought that, you know, at an age where we're supposed to be looking probably our most attractive in biological terms, at around 18, why would we be afflicted by this completely useless state? For example, you know, acne vulgaris, completely useless skin condition. It served no benefit, and it didn't seem like evolution would have determine that for us. Same thing goes with short-sightedness. So many people afflicted with some kind of sight problem, which would be a major selection pressure not to have it in your genes when we were evolving. So clearly there was some kind of modern factor coming into play here. Mm-hmm. And so obviously I was still young at this point, and mainly I was interested in this in terms of how I could benefit myself. Like, I didn't have like anything too bad with me. I was just a normal teenager, but I thought, you know, how can I get better skin? How can I do this and that? And so I really quickly honed in on, it must be the modern diet. So it must be something about our diet more than like some other modern factor, you know, like living indoors or something. It must be the diet. And I was always like jumping, like going from one theory to another theory and trying to make it all fit. Like, you know, examples of this is, you know, zero or low carbohydrate, lower frequency of eating, like sort of kind of intermittent fasting, you know, all these things. And I was trying to like link it, like, why would this have been how we evolved to be? And I really, I was doing the, I was young, but I was scientific, but at times I was doing the opposite of the scientific method, in that I was trying to fit the observations. I was trying to fit the observation to the theory, as opposed to fit the theory to the observations. Mm-hmm. And I bounced from one to the other, like, and I was always convinced that I finally found out what it was. It's, you know, it's like insulin sensitivity or it's something else. And I would always experiment, and my observations, it was always like 80% of the observations matched the theory, but there was always this last bit of it which didn't match the theory. So, and I would really take the experiments to the extreme. Like, so for instance, when I did zero carbohydrate, I didn't just like cut down on you know, potatoes or something. I went completely zero carbohydrate. So I ate only pork belly for three meals a day for 4 months straight. So pork belly is this like very fatty meat from obviously the belly of a pig.
How old were you when you did that?
I did it twice, actually. I was probably like 16 at that time. And then again in university, I think I was about 19.
Yeah, so I was just going to say very quickly, so obviously intermittent fasting and low carbohydrate diets have really come to the fore, you know, again, maybe in the last year or two. So was this kind of during the original, like, Atkins, or like, where did you get these ideas or sort of start to tinker with that? Because this is obviously quite, you know, a few years ago.
Well, most of, as you say, like, most of this stuff is very modern. So the best resource is the internet. And, you know, a few years ago, people would stick with the whole thing about, oh, the internet, you know, you can't get reliable information. But now I think everyone's dropped that, you know, charade, because basically you can get the absolute up-to-date, most scientific information from the internet. Mm-hmm. So when I was like experimenting with zero carbon intermittent fasting, it wasn't some kind of recent blog post or something I had read. It was more like I come up with some kind of way of thinking and it made sense, and then I'd gone and researched the science on the internet. So it wasn't in the later sort of reemergence of like intermittent fasting or anything like that.
Okay.
And so as I was bouncing from experiment to experiment, I was getting good results. So with each experiment, I was getting not just observations, but also beneficial results. So for instance, improvement in skin, improvement in mental clarity, especially with zero carbohydrate, which retrospectively I realized was the concomitant reduction in fermentable compounds, not the actual lowering of carbohydrates. But I'll come back to that. And it was only when, so if there was like some kind of eureka moment or something like that, it was when I learned about the microbiome, and also, let's say, the microbiota, which are the microorganisms in the large intestine, and how that mediates a huge portion of the health effects or the negative health effects of diet are mediated via the bacteria in the gut. When I came to that theory, it was like, oh wow, this explains everything. So this explains all the like anomalies. And obviously I didn't understand everything, because we still don't even understand everything about it. But now I had a mechanism which didn't rely on me trying to warp the warp the observations to the theory. Now this theory would sort of explain everything as I looked into it. So that's how I came to be interested in the kind of probiotic area. So naturally the next thing was, okay, well, how do I manipulate this? If it's true that the microbiota have such an effect on the on health, how do I manipulate this? Let's start with just some experiments. And the main categories that you will look into when you start researching this are antibiotics, probiotics, and prebiotics. And so that's where I started. I mean, I can keep going in detail, but if you want to, like.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting hearing you say it, because I've only really started reading loads about this probably over the last month, but I've become like so fascinated and completely just immersed in reading more and more stuff, because it's like you say, it suddenly is almost like everything starts to make sense, and things that you've puzzled over for the last couple of years, Tommy and I have discussed so much about diet and health, and certain things make sense and then other things just don't quite fit with it. And exactly like you said, we've sort of just discussed different theories, but since I've been reading all about gut health, it's so many things have just sort of slotted into place and started to make a lot more sense. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, for example, when I was experimenting with the zero carb diet, when I started to say, okay, maybe it's the gut bacteria. I can test this theory. I can introduce a carbohydrate which has a very low to nil amount of fiber, so anything in it that would be fermented. And the carbohydrate that I chose was white rice, and in particular short grain white rice. And the so I knew it was going to be a big deal, because when I introduced white rice, even in huge quantities, so it was far from being zero carbohydrate, it still provided all the benefits that I experienced from zero carb. So I knew that it wasn't the zero carb, zero carbohydrate, it was the zero FODMAP aspect of the diet, hence why it was concomitant, and provided the results, even though I was actually basing it off an initial false premise. But so after that, antibiotics, prebiotics, probiotics. Firstly, I didn't investigate antibiotics too much as a method of improving health for a few reasons. But prebiotics, I rapidly came to a conclusion. Now, this conclusion isn't necessarily true now or true in the future, in the near future. But at the time, it was true to me that prebiotics simply were not specific enough. So they didn't discriminate between what bacteria they fed. In other words, they would just feed what was the incumbent microbiota in the large intestine would be all fed, in my mind, evenly by prebiotics. So in other words, if you had a dysbiosis, if you had an unhealthy microbiota, so for you had like an excess of some bacteria which was causing you problems, then taking prebiotics would just exacerbate this because all bacteria would feed on it equally. So if you were healthy, then they would be great. If you had an unhealthy gut, then they would be the opposite. They would be really bad. So they're extremely contextual. So I didn't proceed with prebiotics too much at that time, and I thought, okay, I'll progress into probiotics. And at this time, I was still young, and it was still, how can I just benefit myself? I'm just experimenting with myself. I wasn't thinking of business or anything at that point. And I looked at what was available on the market and did various experiments. And once again, I did pretty extreme experiments, taking like huge amounts of different like commercial offerings. And I didn't really see any benefit. And I was very lucky that I kept going at this point, because this point really could have been just the point that I just thought, this isn't a route that's going to work. But instead, I decided, I have one last idea. And I contacted an institute. This was in Shanghai, actually, because there was a lot of Chinese names on all these research papers. And I asked them to make me this thing, this blend of something. And they were very puzzled, like, why I wanted this, why I wanted this amount, and I wanted it in the raw form. I didn't want it, encapsulated or anything. They told me that, you'll never be able to handle this because it has extremely strict handling requirements, but they sent it anyway. I sent the money, they sent it over. And I started experimenting with it. And this was the beginning of the technology that I later just coined. So it's a nominal Fortress 5. But at this time, it was just me tinkering with how I could modify the vector for probiotic delivery. And the second, like, sort of eureka moment, so to speak, as in the second time I kind of got lucky with a finding, I guess, was when I experimented with this. I didn't expect it really to do anything noticeable, but on about the third day, I noticed that my skin was actually improved. It was smooth, and it was more even, the tone, and it was subtle, but it was definite. There was no doubt about it. It was absolutely definite. And at that point, I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. I couldn't even believe it had worked the first time. And I thought, I'm really onto something here, and I've got a unique insight into this now, because there's not many other people who have done this like random experiment and sort of found this out. And that's the point where I decided to take the technology further, and that's how Elixir began.
So at that point, had you already started thinking about what strains you'd want to include, or was it more about the delivery system?
Well, I knew that. So there's it's a good question, because those are two distinct attributes of a probiotic, and they're actually so separate that you can like classify them as different disciplines. So the strain and the species and everything is like microbiology, and then the delivery vehicle is a bit more towards biomedical engineering or even process engineering, like manufacturing engineering. Mm-hmm. And I knew at that age, and that like financial funding, i.e. zero, basically, I only had the resources to progress with the vector, so like the capsule technology.
Okay.
And I knew that the species and the strains were one of the biggest rooms for improvement is. So right now probiotic technology, ignoring soil based things, just discussing human intestinal bacteria, we only really have economical production capacity for two genera, which is Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, this is, no matter what, brand owners, including myself, no matter what we say in the marketing material, the reality is it's completely insufficient when we're talking about fulfilling the true potential of probiotics. So really, when you ask me about strain selection and species selection, really it was just a case of getting the best out of what was available. Okay. So I really just selected the best out of what was available because I didn't have the ability to go and pick and choose what genera and what species and strains that I wanted to make. Ideally, I'd have hundreds and hundreds of these things, but that's in the future. At the time, I just had to stick with the two genera, which are ubiquitous because they've been in production so long, because humans have used them for in the dairy industry. So coming from a manufacturing engineering point of view, we're very experienced with all the parameters and the requirements for fermenting these things.
Mm-hmm. So for people that are listening in that haven't actually heard about Elixir yet, what actually makes it so different to the other probiotic products on the market then? Because you're saying that most probiotics, apart from the soil-based ones, are limited to the strains they can include. So what is it that makes Elixir so different?
Well, the biggest difference superficially is the CFU count. So CFU is culture forming units, which is how you measure the dosage of a probiotic, and it correlates to the number of cells, bacterial in this case, bacterial cells in the probiotic. And so superficially, the biggest difference is the fact that a dose of Elixir is 50 times as 50 times the number of bacterial cells as the average probiotic. So that's I say superficially because that's just like as far as the consumer is concerned. But on the back end, the manufacturing is easier said than done. So it's easy to say, oh, okay, it's just 50 times. But then the question will be, well, why doesn't everyone do that? Well, it's because the manufacturing technology that other people are using isn't sufficient to get that kind of concentration in the way that I do. Otherwise, yeah, everyone else would just do it. I wouldn't really have an edge, and it would have already been done by now. So superficially, it's quite simple. It's a much higher CFU, and the delivery vector is better. So the capsule technology and the lyophilization process. But deep down, the reason is how I actually got that to work, because it's a lot harder to actually do in practice, because there's I mean, I can go into the details here, but I mean, both of you are educated in this field. So essentially, when you run biofermentation, the limiting factor is you need to control all the variables, so the pH, temperature, and everything. And not only do you need to control them in the beginning, but the metabolic byproducts of bacterial fermentation will actually change those. So a simple example is if a lactic acid bacteria would produce lactic acid, delactate, it would be modifying its own pH. And if you have this in a constricted biofermentation environment, you will need to be measuring that and modifying it. So what I'm just trying to illustrate is that the main difference I would say right now is that as a product, Elixir is a much higher CFU, and the delivery vector is improved. The reason why I can do that is because of the technology. Now, that's as a product. As a company, and this is talking about long-term significance, as a company, the difference is the fact that I'm committed to this is just a starting point. This is nothing compared to the future. So right now, I'd say it's 5% of its potential. For instance, all the funds that I get, the whole point of it is to improve the product. And the first iteration, I was lucky. Well, I wasn't lucky, but I'm fortunate that the first iteration actually had the effect that it did, because it needed to have some effect for people to then start spreading it by word of mouth and telling everyone and for it to start making sales so that I can then fund further research. But the final iteration or the subsequent iterations are going to be like a world apart and much, much better. The first of those are actually being rolled out now. So this isn't some kind of marketing thing we're committed to improving this product, blah blah blah. It's actually really happening. I mean, the first one is already in production right now. The current batch which we're creating is using a superior capsule technology, and it's incremental. It's an incremental improvement. I won't class this one as a significant improvement, but the next modification, which you'll be rolling out in maybe a couple of months, is a modification to the blend. So it's some strain additions and a modification to some of the ratios of the strain. So, and that has a potential to be, that has the potential to be a bit more of a significant improvement, potentially. I can't know until I get feedback from thousands of people, but so far it looks kind of promising. The future, like, huge improvements will come when the company expands and have more funds and more facilities.
One of the other questions I had about it is, why do you recommend only taking the course for 6 days or 12 days rather than other probiotic products that need to be taken continuously? Is that just because of the higher dose? I wondered whether, will the bacteria actually take up residence in the gut, or is their presence only going to be transient? And is that why other probiotics say to take it continuously?
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of people ask that. And a lot of people actually ask me that. They say, can I continue to take it? Because I want to take it because it's effective and I want to keep taking it. But ideally, or idealistically, a probiotic would be a short course type of thing, for two reasons, or two pieces of evidence which would indicate this. First of all, FMTs, which are fecal microbiotic transplants, have been shown to be effective in an acute fashion, as in, you know, a one-off treatment will cause like a remission of, let's say, Clostridium difficile or something like that. So just to briefly explain what FMT is. FMT is where you take a sample from the large intestine of a healthy donor and you transplant it into the large intestine of a unhealthy person. And the theory is that you would be transplanting the microbiota from the healthy person into the unhealthy person. And in the unhealthy person, that healthy microbiota would competitively exclude whatever was ailing them. And in the test that they performed the most, it was on Clostridium difficile, which is a big killer in hospitals, mm-hmm. and it's a very, you know, acute and serious infection of the large intestine, and it had remarkable results, remarkable and permanent results. So now people are starting to expand it into treating IBS and other things. So that's one example of it actually being applied in a short course fashion and being highly effective, other than Elixir. But the theory behind it, it makes much more sense to me, because the large intestine, the bacteria in the large intestine, they're there the whole time, despite whether you're taking probiotics or not. So clearly they are sustaining themselves. It's like an ecological niche. So they're sustaining themselves as long as you're providing them with food, FODMAPs, and even in long durations of fasting, they are sustaining themselves within your large intestine. It's sort of like a permanent infection. That makes it sound really bad, but it's a permanent infection, and it will continue to thrive as long as you do.
It's a symbiosis.
Yeah. It's a symbiosis in that they will benefit us, we will benefit them in an ideal situation. And it's the whole thing, this whole fact that they will sustain themselves. Once they proliferate and colonize epithelial space in the large intestine, they will maintain their own populations. And so the idea with Elixir is, I can't really comment on the strategy of other probiotics, because I just think it's just completely ineffective. But with Elixir, the idea is that ideally you wouldn't need to take it for a long time. In the ultimate perfect permutation of Elixir. Right now, the effect for people that it works really well. The effect, I would say, I mean, they think, some people think it's like permanent. I think it's the type of thing which you would need to top up after anything occurs that may decrease the health of your microbiota, for instance, antibiotics or some GI infection or something like that. But the idea is that if you can seed the gut with the correct bacteria, you know, by delivering the critical mass which is required to competitively exclude the non-beneficial bacteria and to colonize adequate surface area, then they will proliferate on their own and maintain their own population.
And I know you mentioned, we talked about the number of strains, and you were saying that in an ideal probiotic there would be hundreds of strains. Obviously, if Elixir contains 9 different strains, doesn't it?
Yes.
I think I read somewhere, I think it was on freetheanimal.com, I think that's the blog address, an American site, I read something that you had written about. Part of how it works is that even though it doesn't contain all those strains, the bacteria that it does contain are in high enough dose that if they do colonise in the gut, they should lower the pH of the large intestine, and that should allow other beneficial bacteria to proliferate.
Yes, exactly. And this was something that I came to the conclusion after all the good feedback from this first version of Elixir. So I was kind of a little bit surprised that it was working for so many people, because I was thinking, well, really, I've just kind of done what I can with the current technology, and the real benefits will come in the future when I can fund a lot more of my own R&D. But then I started to think, well, there are different levels of effect that probiotics can have. So there's strain specific effects, there's species specific effects, and then there's genus specific effects. And in the case of the lactic acid bacteria in Elixir, I started to think that perhaps, you know, a lot of the effect wasn't necessarily strain specific. It was, well, it was, some of it was species level, but some of it maybe was just genus level. It was the fact that they were lactic acid bacteria, and what they do is they ferment compounds into lactic acid, D-lactate, and this lowers the pH. So it's and it seems to be the case that a lower pH is beneficial to. It is an optimal environment for bacteria which are beneficial to us, and it's not an optimal environment for bacteria which is not beneficial to us. So it was sort of like a really generalized, unfocused, unsurgical chemical that they released that could potentially be causing this generalized beneficial effect, as opposed to, say, a specific bacterial sim which specifically targets some specific species that is not. That is detrimental to our health. It was like a more generalized thing, like changing, like modifying the ambient conditions of the large intestine.
Mm-hmm.
So when earlier you mentioned when you did your first trials of a no carbohydrate diet on yourself, you said you saw benefit, but in very low or no carbohydrate diets or ketogenic diets, we know that probably because of the lack of fermentable carbohydrate, the pH of the gut goes up, so it's less acidic. So can you discuss how those two are linked, how you can decrease the pH of the gut, make it more acidic with these beneficial strains, and that gives a beneficial effect, but you can also cut out carbohydrates, or at least for you personally, you could cut out carbohydrates which would supposedly increase the pH of the gut and you'd still see beneficial effects.
Yeah, sure. So with the zero carb diet and the concomitant elimination or large scale elimination of fermentable oligosaccharides, the result on the large intestine is a huge reduction in total count of bacteria, and this huge reduction in total count of bacteria will be a reduction in beneficial bacteria, yes, but also the detrimental ones, the ones that were causing some negative effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that reduction in total count is way, way, way more significant than the reduction in count of caused by a modification of the pH. So for instance, a simple way of putting it is if you have two warring factions and one of them lowers the pH and it's slightly better for them and it's slightly worse for the others, you'll see a slight increase of the beneficial guys or the good guys and a slight decrease of the bad guys because the environment has been slightly shifted to be favorable to the good guys. Whereas the zero FODMAP diet is basically like saying, okay, I'm just going to starve both factions. No factions are going to get any food and they're all going to decrease in population dramatically. While that will obviously cause a huge decrease in the benefit in the good bacteria, it will cause a dramatic decrease in the bad bacteria as well, and much more than just putting them in unfavorable pH conditions. So it's a case that, so your point is good, but it's a case that the reduction in food is much more significant than modifying the pH.
But is that a good strategy for people to adopt long term, to just starve everything out?
Well, there's a couple of problems with this long term. Now, first of all, I'd say, talking about zero FODMAP, because I wouldn't recommend zero carbohydrate anyway, since zero FODMAP is superior. But long term, okay, so here are the problems. Firstly, the reason it's not that zero FODMAP is some, it's not the paleo way of thinking, where I agree, by the way, with the paleo concept, which is the healthiest diet would be what we were exposed to during our evolution and over a long enough duration that our genetics had adapted to that diet and had time to deselect those people who were maladapted to that diet. So I agree with that concept. Now, the zero FODMAP diet isn't something that I would say is like, oh, this is what we've evolved to eat. It's not that it's a solution to a modern problem, and it's actually just a temporary solution because it only lasts as long as you do it. And there's a couple of sort of drawbacks to it. The first one is kind of obvious. If all you eat is meat and fat, and then a low fiber carbohydrate such as rice, there's micronutrients that you're missing out on. So while you are getting the full array of macronutrients, you're getting carbohydrates, so you're functioning on carbohydrates as we are adapted to, and you have the proteins which we need, and you have the fats that we need. You won't be getting the micronutrients that are present in other things like root vegetables, such as vitamins and minerals. Mm-hmm. So that's a drawback, and that's kind of obvious. It's obvious when you look at a plate. If you looked at the meals I was eating, it would be very obvious because it was white rice and white chicken and you know, something like that. It just looks a bit deficient. Mm-hmm. But the less obvious one, and one that I've experienced myself, is you can actually, while it is a tremendous short, like fast acting, treatment for people with IBS or any condition linked to the to dysbiosis, it's very effective. It's really effective, and while it's very rapid and very effective, it can actually set you up to have more problems with food when you introduce them later, because the mechanism is like this. Okay, I'll explain the result first. The result could be like this. You let's keep it simple. You experience bloating from eating too many, like, let's say, potatoes, because there's an oligosaccharide in potatoes, and it causes you to get bloated because it happens to be feeding some bacteria which is producing some bacteria or archaea which is producing some gas in your large intestine, and it's not supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. So you'd stop eating those potatoes because you've cut out all FODMAPs, and great, the symptoms go away. But what you might find is that when you start eating a normal diet again, now you're sensitive to other things. So now you're lactose intolerant, and now these other things are giving you problems like bloating. And it may be temporary, or it may last for quite a long, it may last indefinitely. And the reason for this, and it's also the reason why people say introduce fiber slowly. They rarely give like a proper explanation. They just say introduce fiber slowly because the body needs to adapt. But we all know that's not a scientific explanation. It's just like pseudo, you know, what does it mean? It's too vague. Like, the body needs to adapt. What does that mean? But the reason is this: when you go on a zero FODMAP diet, you are now reducing all these compounds, all these mainly oligosaccharides, which are feeding bacteria in your gut. So as they all go away, loads of populations of different species are now decreasing, and they're decreasing down to a point where they may no longer be the critical mass where they could competitively exclude a non-beneficial bacteria when you start to feed them back up. So when you do start to feed them back up, let's say something that didn't previously give you problems, it's like sweet potato or something, when you then start eating that again, now it's a bit of like a potluck, which bacteria get the upper hand on metabolizing that, the FODMAPs within that food type, and then increase in population. And what you can often find is that some non-beneficial bacteria could get the upper hand and start increasing the population and competitively exclude a bacteria which you previously had in abundance because you were maintaining the population with a regular influx of the fiber that was in sweet potato or the FODMAP that's in milk, etc. like that. So when you come back to reintroducing other food types, you can now actually be more intolerant. And this occurred with me.
You can almost have created a worse dysbiosis than what you had in the first place.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So you were just going to say that's what happened to you?
Yeah, it's what happened to me. So, like, you know, when I cut out dairy, I became lactose intolerant when I reintroduced it. And when I cut out, when I cut out everything, when I started just eating zero carb and zero FODMAP, when I started reintroducing them now, loads more things were giving me problems. And some of them were temporary. I could bear through it and then I'll be fine. So a lot of people, when they start introducing massive amounts of some kind of like vegetable or something, they may experience bloating for the first few days, but then it goes away. And the reason for that in my mind, and I think it was, I kind of touched upon this in the article that I did on Free the Animal, is that they evidently had the critical mass of beneficial bacteria which are adapted to metabolize that substrate to the extent that they would eventually, i.e. within 3 or 4 days, build up the critical mass to competitively exclude the non-beneficial bacteria. However, with something like IBS, evidently in that situation, they just don't have that critical mass. So the more you keep on continuing to feed them this exacerbating substrate, the dysbiosis is perpetual. It just remains there because this non-beneficial bacteria has such a hold that it's not going away. And evidently it's also pretty well adapted to metabolize that substrate.
So if you're in a situation where, say, you've got some dysbiosis or you have really bad IBS or something like that, and there are some key sort of ancestral bacterial species that we think are important for everybody to have for, you know, good metabolic health or good gastrointestinal health, you know, something like Akkermansia mucinophilia or Faecalibacterium prausnitzii. And these are obviously not things that are in Elixir, right? But the idea is that you try and create an environment where you can bring back some of these beneficial, you know, bacterial strains if you don't have them. So if you take Elixir, say, and you kind of feel like you've set yourself up for a good, or any probiotic where you do anything to kind of set yourself up to start creating a better gut microbiome, what do you then need to do? So what did you do, or what do you think people should do? Because obviously Elixir by itself isn't necessarily going to do that.
Yeah. So let's say you did experience significant improvement from taking Elixir. The question then is, how do we lock in these improvements, so to speak? And a kind of a mentally easy thing to segue to is prebiotics. So now I've corrected the dysbiosis, I can now take prebiotics. However, the reality is that, like I said, Elixir, and most people don't really say this about their own product, but Elixir is only 5% of the potential of probiotics. So it's likely that someone with severe IBS could get remission from Elixir, but they wouldn't necessarily then be able to completely go overboard with all kinds of FODMAPs, uh-huh. all kinds of prebiotics. But having said that, if there were some prebiotic blend available which had a multitude of different FODMAPs in that had been selected based on microbiome assays and large amounts of data to correlate it with how it affects the profile of the microbiota, then you would say, and this is in the future, this isn't something now, but this is in the future, the ideal thing would be this: you would create the dysbiosis with Elixir probiotic, and then you would maintain it or even sort of concrete the gains and even improve the gains by then feeding this now improved microbiota, and you would do that via this sort of broad spectrum prebiotic blend. Currently though, I mean, I would like to say, oh yeah, just take Elixir and then you take inulin and, you know, it's all locked in, but this is incorrect and unscientific. So in the future, the answer to your question will be, you take Elixir and then you start taking a prebiotic But right now, the prebiotics and even the probiotics are not at that stage. So yeah. I think the best thing now is to get as much improvement out of a probiotic as possible, and then to slowly reintroduce FODMAPs in your diet and be very really slowly scale up anything that exacerbates any of your previous symptoms.
There are a few people out there in the sort of blogosphere that obviously all of this is just people experimenting on themselves, but there's a guy called Wilbur, who I think you've had some chats with online, I've seen on sort of comments on blogs, who takes a huge number of prebiotic fibers every single day, that he just sort of experimented with, and has, obviously you don't know if any of these claims are true, but people saying they've really improved their health by taking almost what you're describing, but they're just experimenting themselves. So some inulin, potato starch, green banana flour, all different kinds of things. And they're just sort of experimenting on themselves, really, like you have, to find out what works.
Yes, that's right. And Wilbur described was a very, you know, elaborate thing, and that's exactly what we need. And to be honest, one of the things I started working on slightly before Elixir was something in that category, and this is going to be huge without kind of explaining too much about, because this is off topic here, but that's going to be huge. A broad spectrum prebiotic blend is going to be huge, and it could be even more significant than a probiotic, because of the fact that it's a natural intervention, whereas probiotics are obviously unnatural. I mean the idea of taking in a huge bolus of bacteria via the oral route is obviously not natural, other than during natural birth, so the one time at the beginning of our lives when it is natural. Whereas taking fiber on a daily basis is natural. Mm-hmm. It's just that the argument would be our current diet doesn't have the prebiotic content that we were supposed to be taking. So here's a supplement. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing huge amounts of research in this area, and I've come up with a lot of very significant findings lately. So that's definitely something I'll be sort of elaborating on in the future.
So Carl, you're probably familiar with Grace Liu, I imagine, who runs her website is Dr. BG Animal Farm, farm.ph.blogspot.com. And she's kind of in the paleo sphere, or, you know, in that kind of, in the wider context, she's sort of considered to be one of the experts on the gut microbiome, and has numbers of highly complicated posts about what, you know, fibers do and probiotics do. And she talks about something, she calls it a bionic fiber program, which is a combination of inulin, glucomannan, and acacia root. And she's really big into RS3, so resistant starch 3, which is like, you know, crystallized starches from things like rice or potatoes after they've been left to cool after cooking. And then non-starch polysaccharides as well, to kind of try and, you know, as you know, prebiotics. But do you feel like there isn't enough evidence to support that kind of supplementation?
No, I think what she's doing is perfect. It will be one of the most potent supplements you could possibly take to improve your health.
Okay,
this broad spectrum blend. Now, I mean, I've like to be honest, I really should be reading a lot more of these blogs than I do. But I have seen a bit of the stuff that she's written, and I've not like read enough. I really do need to read it. In fact, she's one of the blogs that I need to read the most. But I've briefly seen what she does, and the thing I really love about it is that, and I've really not read that much, so correct me if I'm wrong, but she takes these broad spectrum fiber blends, and then she uses a company called Ubiome to assay the micro. Her microbiome, which obviously correlates with the microbiota, and she kind of like sees how it modifies it. So this is like the you know, quintessential. She's the quintessential scientist in that regard, experimenting on herself and measuring it in a quantitative manner.
And she has clients as well. She's worked with quite a number of people sort of doing a similar protocol.
Well, I don't really know much about it. I actually didn't. I just recognized.
Yeah, but that's like what you describe is exactly is the protocol that she follows. Yeah,
and her articles look really good. They look really good. I need to read them, but they do look very good. And what she's doing is essentially what I'm researching right now.
I think it's really interesting. It's really interesting that you bring up Ubiome because Tommy and I have just been sent a kit from them.
Oh, yeah.
And I've already sent mine back. I don't know, Tommy, if you've done yours yet.
No, I'll do it next month because it's in the UK and I'm still in Norway. So
it's definitely something that we've both started sort of reading a lot more about. And I was going to ask you about that. Have you done much testing on actually people that have taken Elixir and then seeing like maybe a Ubiome sample before they took it and then after? Because obviously that would be something that would be really interesting to see what the results are.
Yeah, that would definitely be interesting. And that's one of the next things that I'm going to be, I think one of the next things I'm going to be publishing. Because the way that I found out about Ubiome, funnily enough, was someone contacted me with, and they had Crohn's. Well, they said they had Crohn's, but I think it was ulcerative colitis that they actually had. But that's besides the point. What they had done was they had done a Ubiome test, and they basically came to me with this whole array of data. I hadn't even talked to them before. This whole array of data which they had taken before Elixir, during Elixir, after Elixir, several weeks after Elixir, and it was phenomenal because they had sort of done it they had done me a massive favor because they just presented all this data to me, and I was amazed that this person had identified dramatic changes in his microbiome. Now, I don't know whether that would be as dramatic in someone who didn't have such a serious condition as ulcerative colitis, but then it got me thinking. Okay, great. I can start doing all these things. There's other people. There was two other people after that who came to me and said they'd done Ubiome tests, and they monitored the differences caused by Elixir. So I thought this is real significant because it will be a quantitative sort of inarguable effect that Elixir is having. Wow. However, I've not put them. So one of them off. I said I can just use this wherever I want, but I've not put them up on my site because there are a few restrictions that govern health supplements with regards to. I don't want to imply any health benefits.
No.
I've got to be careful that I don't imply health benefits. And a few of the rules in the EU are quite strict about testimonials or results that imply health benefits. So,
I have actually taken a course of Elixir at the beginning of July. And I've just done the Ubiome test, but stupidly, I should have done a Ubiome test before I took Elixir and after, but I actually haven't heard about Ubiome, I don't think, until after I took the Elixir course. But I will let you know my results when I get them back anyway, because it'll be interesting to look at them and see what they show.
Yeah. What Ubiome are doing with the big data approach is going to be very significant and valuable. And also American Gut are doing the same thing, where they... kind of correlate the use questionnaires to try and correlate all these factors with what the profile of the microbiome looks like. So I don't know what the questions they are that they ask, but ones that would be obvious to me would be: do you have any skin conditions? Do you have any allergies? Do you have any and all these other questions? And then when they've got thousands and thousands of results, you can start to correlate. An excess of this bacteria is correlated with pollen allergy, or a deficiency in this bacteria is correlated with bloating or something. It wouldn't be that vague, but that's the idea with big data.
You can also do it over here now via the British Gut Project. I think it's the britishgutproject.org. We can put all these links in the show notes, but they are doing the same as the American Gut Project, but just over here for the British. So you just send your sample off to the UK.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Go on.
Oh, sorry. It's interesting you mentioned the American Gut Project because I think it was some guys working through that developed a probiotic called Equilibrium. Have you heard of that? Where basically what they did is they took, I think it was maybe 250 people, and they looked at their gut microbiome and they looked at or maybe it might have been more than that, but basically they looked at the key strains that were missing in those that were healthy and those that had some kind of disease. And I think they've got 100 plus strains that they've put in this probiotic called Equilibrium.
Okay.
I was just interested in what you think of that, whether because you talked about the way Elixir works at the moment is because it sort of sets up the gut to kind of host the bacteria that you want to be hosting, versus actually using those to be the major species that are resident in the gut. So I was just wondering what you thought about that, you know, whether you think that's a useful approach or whether you feel that, you know, there won't be enough of those bacteria in the probiotics actually, you know, make any difference in terms of delivery and, you know, CFUs.
Well, depending on how many CFUs they have, I reckon the biggest barrier will be that they just don't have enough, because there's restrictions on the density of how high you can get CFUs in a certain amount of powder, based on the biofermentation process. So removing the mainly removing metabolic byproducts and how you do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it will be sort of akin to developing caffeine. First coming up with caffeine, the caffeine molecule, and showing in these studies how it improves, you know, alertness, but then putting, let's say, one part per million in a drink, and then you drink it and it does nothing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you put 35 milligrams per 100 mils, then it does something. So I can't comment on that. I hadn't actually heard of that one.
I'm just looking at their website now. So
I have some, and it's not a high CFU count.
It's 1 billion CFU from 115 strains, they say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that would be that would be obviously a 50th of a five. What was it? 1 billion.
One billion. Yeah.
500 of what Elixir is doing. So that's quite a significant difference, a factor of 500. I would be very surprised, but you know, I don't want to say anything bad about them, but I'd be very surprised if 1 billion would do much.
Okay. Interesting.
My basic argument for why my dose isn't actually high, it's reasonable, is quite simple. The number of microorganisms in the gut is approximated in the number that's most often quoted is 100 trillion. So if we do the maths on 1 billion, that wouldn't just be like a tenth or whatever. It would be a hundredth of a thousandth.
Yeah.
Of what it, so it'd be one to 100,000 ratio. And if you imagine sending in one guy against an army of 100,000, well, let's say only 20,000 of them are actually the enemy. Even 20,000 against one, it's just like a drop in the ocean.
Okay.
However, I can't comment on it because I've never tested it. But how many strains did you say there was?
It's 115 strains.
And does it detail which ones they are?
No. So there's been a lot of discussion about this. People asking about the strains because obviously they don't want to take something that they're not sure about. But as yet, I think because of it's either various patent problems or various research problems, they haven't been able to fully disclose their strains. I don't think, not yet.
Right.
They are hoping to. They do say that. I think
I would be as an actual manufacturer. I don't know if these guys are a manufacturer, just like a brand owner. But as a manufacturer, I would guess that most of these are like soil-based organisms and that type of thing. You know, all the type of things you find in kefir.
Yeah.
You know, all these ones that nothing to do with the human large intestine. At the moment, the only ones in production, commercial levels of production, are two genera: Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus, and the rest are soil-based organisms, which I don't think have much. Well, personally, I don't think have much to do with anything in terms of the future of probiotics.
Mm-hmm. I had one other question. I don't know how we're doing for time.
I'm fine with time.
Okay. I had a question which was actually about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO.
Yeah.
So it seems to be a huge problem that a lot of people are suffering from. And Grace Liu has quite a lot of stuff on her website about it, actually. She has this 7 steps protocol, which, again, we can post a link to in the show notes. But on the whole, probiotics should be avoided because of the fact that they might increase the bacteria growing in the small intestines, which is obviously where they shouldn't be, and that's what's causing these people their problems. Would Elixir be suitable because of the technology that you've developed? So can you be confident that the bacteria will only be released in the large intestine with no risk of it being released in the small intestine? And will that actually help SIBO or not?
Well, so this is a question I get asked a lot about SIBO. The first thing to mention, and you may be aware of this from clinical experience, but SIBO, self-diagnosed SIBO, is a pretty kind of tenuous thing, similar to self-diagnosed candida, as people call it. And the way you actually diagnose SIBO would be a small intestinal aspiration, and then you would assay that sample and do a bacterial count per milliliter and establish whether this falls in the range of bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine. But another kind of clinical method is a breath test, which is where you take a compound such as lactulose, and you then measure in intervals, time intervals, you measure either the methane or the hydrogen output in the breath. Mm-hmm. And this test isn't that accurate because, first of all, GI transit time varies from individual to individual. Secondly, lactulose happens to have an extremely short transit time. So people will measure a positive on the breath test at 60 minutes. And it's actually a fact that lactulose can reach the large intestine in 60 minutes anyway. So much faster than people think. The other thing is that so there's a lot of false positives on the breath test. The other thing is that most people who have SIBO have just self-diagnosed it, and they've done it based off either something they've just based off a list of symptoms, or based off like they get bloated, and then the rationale is, oh, but my bloating occurs only an hour after eating, so it must be SIBO because it's not reached the large intestine, which first of all, it can reach the large intestine that fast, certain substrates, and secondly, due to the phase lag of how one meal affects, how one meal reaches the large intestine and affects fermentation there, it could actually be bloating from a previous meal or previous day. So the only point that I want to make about that before I then answer the question is a lot of self-diagnosed SIBO isn't actually SIBO. Okay. And I could say that from small amount of clinical experience, but I'm sure that you have more than me in this regard. So for people who actually do have SIBO, like let's say it was diagnosed by intestinal aspiration or even by a methane or hydrogen breath test, the thing about Elixir is this: if you have SIBO, and it's due to it will be likely due to an anatomical defect in the small intestine, because the small intestine is very good at keeping itself sterile via various chemical means, and also via the peristalsis in one direction, whereas in the large intestine it's not like that. So it's very good at keeping itself relatively sterile, order of magnitude lower bacterial count than the large intestine. Now if you take Elixir, first of all, Elixir doesn't, the dissolution of Elixir does occur in the small intestine, and it's intended to do that. So it isn't delayed until the large intestine. It's slightly more delayed in the update that I'm rolling out very soon. Now I didn't delay. First of all, the first iteration will probably go into dissolution in the duodenum and even the stomach in some cases. And I kept this intentionally because a lot of people started reporting that they had resolution of heartburn or like GERD. And I thought, well, this is interesting because this was one of the things I didn't predict and one of the things I hadn't experienced in myself because I didn't have GERD. And I thought, well, potentially then the bacteria is having some kind of competitive exclusionary effect in the stomach on Helicobacter pylori, potentially. Or maybe it's having a downstream effect in the large intestine and then this is being relayed somehow upstream to the stomach. It could have been one of those two. But as I progressed and got further feedback of many people, especially Americans who were consuming these different concoctions of resistant starch and things like that, I started to think that the pros of delaying dissolution will outweigh the pros of having it go into dissolution in the stomach, despite the effect on GERD. And
so, by just quickly, I'd just say GERD, or we'd call it GORD potentially in the UK for gastroesophageal reflux disease.
That's right.
Yeah, just in case people got confused.
Yeah. That's right. So, because the esophagus is spelled different in the US.
Yeah.
And so But like I said, I just decided to go with delaying the dissolution by increasing the time that it takes for the capsule to break apart and release the blend. But it's still not occurring in the large intestine. It's occurring in the small intestine. Now, SIBO won't occur even from a huge dose like Elixir because the peristalsis is one way. It's directed from the duodenum along the jejunum to the ileum through the ileocecal valve to the large intestine. There's no upstream kind of movement normally. So the only time that the bacteria could accumulate long enough to start proliferating will be if you had an anatomical defect, like a blind loop or even diverticuli. The chemical environment in the small intestine is very good at keeping it relatively sterile. So there certainly wouldn't be the concern of it of the lactic acid bacteria in Elixir binding to the small intestine epithelium and sort of proliferating there. So it wouldn't cause SIBO. As for whether it would help SIBO, the mechanism by which it potentially could, it will be the time that it takes in transit. Is very short, but it could have the potential to begin proliferation there, begin metabolizing substrate and releasing lactic acid and other bacteriocins, which could, you know, be transiently directed at any incumbent bacterial overgrowth. However, I don't think SIBO is as prevalent as people think it is, and I also. I did read that thing on that blog about bionic fiber and SIBO, and while bionic fiber seems like a really promising idea of investigation, I wasn't sure that SIBO would be the thing it would target the most. I really think that improving the microbiota in the large intestine is where it's like really its potential truly lies.
And so, a lot of people that think they have SIBO, you would think is still just a dysbiosis in the large intestine.
Exactly, and the reason why they may experience it very rapidly after consuming food is that they'll be under the impression that food takes several hours to get to large intestine, and while certain macronutrients, certain substrates do, other ones don't. So, for instance, if you eat a big chunk of steak, it could be in the stomach for 4 hours before it even moves into the duodenum. But if you, let's say, drank a solution of lactulose or even fructose or something like that. Because it's in liquid form, and because of the hypertonic nature of the solution, it can have a transit time as low as 60 minutes.
Okay.
So that changes the whole model. So it changes the assumption.
And also because of the way the gut works, it has sort of like a feed forward mechanism. So if you put something into the stomach, it will increase the speed of transit of things lower down. So if you ate something, you'd get a gastrocolic, for instance, reflex. So you'd start to move things down into the colon faster to make room for what's coming through. So if you eat something, you might actually increase the speed of what you ate before into the colon, which would then potentially cause your symptoms.
Exactly. That's a great point. And so the two mechanisms by which that occurs is the physical stretch reflex, and then also the chemical makeup of what you eat, like its tonicity. Is it sort of hypertonic, and what type of macronutrient is it? Like, is it a protein? If it's a protein, if it's a fat, the stomach can detect this and it can retain it longer. If it's a carbohydrate, that will be best moved to the small intestine and broken down there. Then the GI tract can detect this. But you make a great point about one, like a domino effect. One meal could actually shouldn't a previous meal. Into the large intestine and then cause the bloating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's been really, really interesting, actually. Lots of great insight there, Carl. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
We've reached our hour pain threshold, which is where my mum has fallen asleep and we have no listeners left. So
okay.
If you could just tell us how people find you. You know, you've written some blogs on Free the Animal, for example, and just so people can find out more about the product or your work in general.
Yeah, sure. So I have written only one article so far, and that's on freetheanimal.com. My website, you can find me, which is www.elixa-probiotic.com, Elixir Probiotic. It's the way that Americans pronounce elixir. So I decided to spell it that way because they're my biggest market. But to be honest, I've been so busy lately that there's not a huge amount of content on the website. I've got a ton of articles drafted. So if people check back there, maybe in a month or time, they'll see a ton of articles. They'll also see more articles coming out on Free the Animal. But definitely the best way to find me would be just send me an email from the website. I do most of my correspondence via email. So I have tons of people emailing me asking loads of questions.
So will you be providing lots of, you know, scientific references and scientific content and that kind of thing over the, is that what you envisage happening?
Yeah, I think I'll do a variety of articles. So some will be more scientific with references to studies and using sort of the jargon of science, and others will be for more layman terms. I intend to do a bit of video content to illustrate to people visually a few of the concepts. But to be honest, I'm gonna keep it fairly layman. I'm not gonna dumb down the science, but people much prefer an explanation that makes sense to them rather than a little number two and then the reference this some study on PubMed. They much prefer just to have the concept explained in full. So I'll probably go with the non Oxford dissertation style.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks very much. Carl, it's been great. We'll put this all up and give links to everything and everything we talked about, the various gut projects and some of the research. And thanks again, Chloe, for coming up with most of the questions, as usual.
Nice to talk to you.
And we'll speak to you next time. Cheers, guys.
Thank you very much, Tommy. Thank you, Chloe. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, Carl.
Bye.
Bye.